freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
Well, it's our Memorial Day show here on Women's Magazine, and we're talking about the links between the militarism that pervades our culture and our conceptions of masculinity. And one of the most intense expressions of that connection is the history of lynching. Between 1864 and the mid-1960s, at least 4,000 African Americans were lynched in this country. And contrary to our conception of these events, lynchings were often highly public, attended by thousands of ordinary people, and they were heavily photographed. Often, but not always, the justification for this racial violence was a perceived assault on a white woman's virtue. So the policing of white women's sexuality often led to false accusations that resulted in deaths of black men. Yesterday, a friend invited me to the screening of a film in progress called Always in Season, which delves into the legacy of this incredibly brutal and seldom spoken of chapter in our history. I was incredibly moved by this film, and fortunately the filmmaker, Jacqueline Olive, agreed to come in and talk to me about it. Jacqueline Olive coordinated the production of the Emmy Award-winning PBS broadcast documentary series Independent Lens and the internationally themed series Global Voices. She also created the hour-long documentary film Black to Our Roots, which broadcast on PBS World. Jackie is directing, producing, and writing the documentary film Always in Season, which highlights the stories of relatives of lynching victims and spectators to show the lingering impact of almost a century of lynching of African Americans. She's also working on an accompanying multimedia platform in the virtual world Second Life called Always in Season Island. Hopefully we'll have time to talk about that, which sounds just fascinating. Jackie, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, as I said, I was terribly moved by some of the stories in the excerpt that I saw yesterday. Talk about how you became involved in this project.
I am from Mississippi. I grew up in the South and knew of the racial violence that was really prevalent in Mississippi and prevalent in most of the South. And I knew that despite that history, no one was talking about it. There was kind of this silence around race and racism. People just wanted to really get along and move forward, yet that history still hung in the air. It's really palpable. You can be in areas of Mississippi and where there are trees and lots of foliage, and it's kind of, you know, in the woods, and it's kind of in an isolated area, and you can feel the violence that happened there. You can literally feel it. And so when I finished graduate school, I graduated from the University of Florida Documentary Institute in 2007 and was looking at what project I wanted to work on first. I remember the Without Sanctuary exhibit of lynching photographs and postcards. And Without Sanctuary is a collection of about 100 photographs and postcards where spectators who came out by the thousands at times are posing with the victims. Prior to that, I thought of lynchings as simply black men hanging, anonymous faces, and I never really thought about the people and who they were until I saw those images. And those images are startling. They are often difficult to look at. But when you take the time, then you're drawn into the humanity of those individuals. And I realized they look like my friends. They look like my family, my neighbors, people that I knew. And I really wanted to learn more. And that's how I started researching the project and ultimately decided that this was the work for me.
And you mentioned some of the, I think, misconceptions that a lot of us have about lynchings, among them that these were things that happened sort of silently in the dark in a swamp somewhere with no one around. And the stories that you tell are very different. What are some of the other myths that we have about lynching?
Sure. Yeah. I held those same myths until I started researching. So in terms of the facts about lynching, I'll tell you that the record is about 4,000 to 5,000 lynchings during a period of a century from about 1884 to 1964. But historians actually believe, because those were the documented cases, that there were probably at least twice as many more. Men, women, and children attended lynchings. They came out to watch it as if it were a family event. And parents would get excuses. They'd send notes to their teachers, their kids' teachers, to let them out of school to watch, to attend. You think of lynchings and you think of Klansmen, like you said, in the backwoods. But often they were in broad daylight. They were in the middle of the courthouse square. There's an expert on the project, Sherilyn Eiffel, who's this wonderful civil rights attorney and law professor at the University of Maryland, who wrote the book on the courthouse square, where she talks about and chronicles lynchings that happened on the courthouse square in the middle of town. Often the victim would have been dragged from jail, which was blocks away, to the courthouse square. So you think about how far... Think about the middle of your downtown and how far a city block is, and all of those people that the victim was dragged past. All those people that saw it, all those people who knew, people who were in the local businesses, maybe having ice cream in the ice cream shop. Often lynchings happened in small towns where there were thousands of people who attended, and at no other point was there an event that large in that town. So you think of the noise of thousands of people in a town where this is a seminal event for that town. So even the people who were in their homes, in all likelihood, would have known a lynching was going on just from the sound of what was going on in downtown. The biggest myth is that lynchings happened only in the South. And they did happen in the South, and they were prevalent in the South, but they also occurred in every state before. I believe Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and Maine, I believe, is the fourth state that didn't have lynchings. So other than those states, lynchings happened. And so they occurred across the country. If you think about the fact that there were 5,000, possibly even 10,000 victims of lynchings, and at a single lynching, 10,000 to 15,000 people attended, you can see the impact from one lynching and then multiply that by thousands. And so my interest really in this topic was not just about looking at the history, but looking at how it impacted the entire country then. And because of the denial that you spoke about, because often the conversation around lynchings was shut off immediately once the event happened. Once the event happened and people realized how out of hand things had gotten in their town, they didn't want to be characterized that way. So journalists would write in the newspaper for no one to talk about it. And so there's this level of denial around the violence that occurred and a lack of conversation about horrific lynchings that would often occur over hours. And so the victim would be tortured and mutilated and then finally killed in the presence of thousands. And so without a conversation about that, all of the anger, all of the pain, all of the guilt and the shame around that is then buried. And so I'm really curious about what was passed on. When you have to live with that, what do you pass on to your children and they pass on to their children?
Does the film focus on just a few stories or is it very broad, trying to encompass the history of a century of these events?
It's a good question. I actually started off very broad, I think, as a lot of projects do. I was really interested in the issue. And then, you know, the process of filmmaking, you then try to nail it down into a story that really works for what you're trying to say. So it is broad in the sense that I want to give people the scope. I want people to understand what the stakes were, because the purpose is also to show what lynchings have to do with racism and hate today. Lynchings happened at one point at their peak 3 to 4 times a week. And so that's the kind of information that I want people to have. But I'm giving that information in the context of people who are today, relatives of the victims, relatives of the perpetrators, relatives of the spectators, and just ordinary people who are coming together to look at restorative justice around lynching. So I'm focusing on three communities around the country where lynchings have occurred. One, I can't really talk about right now because we're fine-tuning the details on that. The second community, and they each represent the different stages of restorative justice, right? So the first community is about acknowledgement and what happens when a lynching isn't acknowledged. The second community is Monroe, Georgia, where since 2003, they have been doing a reenactment around a lynching that happened there. Two couples were murdered there. So annually, they do the reenactment so that people don't forget the victims, but also the perpetrators. Some of them are still living in that community, and they want to bring them to justice. So that's the second stage that I'm looking at, are steps towards restorative justice. And then the third stage is reconciliation, and I'm filming in Duluth, Minnesota, where lynching happened there, and I chose that location in particular. One, because one of the more iconic photographs of the Without Sanctuary exhibit is from that lynching in Duluth. But also people don't expect that lynchings happened that far north. People in Duluth are surprised. They have been working towards justice around that lynching since about 2005 and now are starting to move towards reconciliation.
So the story that you mentioned in Monroe, Georgia, so that involved, you said, two couples, and one of the women was pregnant.
Yes.
And actually, there's a really powerful clip in which describes in kind of harrowing detail how her baby was actually torn from her womb.
Yes. The reenactment was organized by a man named Bobby Howard, who's from Monroe, and has been working to bring people to justice in that lynching for 45 years. And he began doing reenactments with his family members because no one else wanted to be involved. No one wanted the stigma in that town of being a part of this conversation about lynching. And then over the years, he's found actors, and they're all amateur actors, and found a great director who's been directing the reenactments for the last 3 to 5 years, Cassandra Green. And she is really wonderful, and she does local plays, and so she's really gotten the feel for this. But it's basically people who are very passionate about getting the story out.
And you mentioned also the incident in Duluth, and that was one of the situations in which a white woman's accusation of rape led to 6 young men being killed.
Yes.
Can you tell what's known about that story?
Yeah, sure. So what's known is that a woman named Irene Tuscan and her boyfriend, Jimmy, left home. They had gone to the circus, and they had spent time together. And there's not really any detail about why the story came about, but at some point during the evening, they decided that they needed to cover themselves by saying that Irene was raped. So by the time that they got home, they had told her mother and father that she had been raped. And then as pressure started mounting to figure out what's going on, who the guilty party was, the story grew. And it grew to where she eventually accused 6 black circus workers of having raped her. And they actually pulled the 6 circus workers in and ended up lynching 3 of them. One of those men is the cousin of one of the men featured in the documentary. His name is Don Clariot. First of all, a committee of people in Duluth decided to get together to build the first memorial to lynching victims there. And so they really worked hard and brought the community together. There was a lot of resistance. But ultimately, after a year or two of fundraising and locating a sculptor who's really talented, they built a memorial to the victims there. And I'm also looking at not just that move towards restorative justice, but then once there's justice and once there's repair, then how do you come together and heal and have a conversation around that?
And as part of that conversation, a descendant of the woman whose accusation led to that lynching has come forward, and he's interviewed in your film.
Yes.
Talk about how that happened. And he says in the film that prior to this memorial being built, he never stepped onto the property where the incident took place. So how did he end up coming forward now and being included in your film?
Yeah, it was really a blessing for me. His name is Mike Tuscan, and he's a beautiful man. He is the police of chief, one of the chiefs of police in Duluth, Minnesota, and had not known at all about his family history, about the lynching. No one had talked about it. When I met Mike, he had been approached by journalists several times about talking about it and just hadn't. He felt guilty about it, and he felt ashamed of it, even though it wasn't him and it was a family member. He felt really ashamed and also really hesitant because he was afraid that people would think of him as racist. And he was one of the chiefs of police. When I spoke with him, the timing was just right. He had spoken with Warren Reed, whose great-great-grandfather had organized that lynching. And Warren had just found out about it a few years before and written a book called The Lyncher in Me, which was his account, his personal memoir, and account of his family's role in that lynching. Mike Tuscan, because he had talked to Warren and because Warren had approached him and had really given him the example of someone who also had this difficult role in this lynching, a role that felt pretty impossible to really talk about and have a conversation about because Warren had done it, then Mike was encouraged to then move forward and do it as well. And it was despite family members suggesting that maybe he shouldn't.
And why did you call this project Always in Season?
Yeah, I called it Always in Season for a couple of reasons. The one that first motivated me was as I started to research, I spent 3 to 4 years, just about 4 years researching this project. And the more that I learned and the more that I realized that lynching was akin to the sport of hunting. Often lynchings were advertised. There were telegraph invitations. There were written invitations. There were flyers. There were excursion trains that were reserved for people from out of town so that they could come and attend the lynching. They were highly organized, events so that even when there was no crime committed, just because it was a Saturday evening, Friday evening, there was nothing to do, a victim would be found and publicly murdered. For blacks, it was like they were always in season. The other reason why I call it Always in Season is because unless this history is confronted, and unless we really look at what it means for our lives, those things that are passed down, how it impacts us, then there'll always be someone else in season for being targeted. It could be issues around homophobia. It could be issues around targeting immigrants, all of those ways that we pass on racism and hate today.
One of the things that that makes me think of is the scene that always accompanies an execution. I've spent so many nights standing around at San Quentin waiting for somebody to be killed, with those of us who hate this violence on one side and people yelling for blood, often drinking and playing loud music on the other. And I'm wondering if these were highly organized public events in the white community, then the black community, first of all, must have also known that these plans were in the works. And did they come together in any ways to organize to try to stop it or to try to protect each other? Like, what were they doing while the white people were passing out flyers advertising a lynching?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the concerns for me, and it's always been a concern of mine. Often blacks were not just victims. They organized to protect themselves as best they could, given the situation. But lynching was this kind of, it was on a continuum of terror. And so the first step might be that you prevented someone from getting a job because they were a bit too sure of themselves and a bit too confident. They were out of their place. And then it could be a murder or it could be a beating. But at the point at which lynchings happened, it was about terrorism and it was about terrorizing the African community. And it was about a way of getting black people to police themselves. And so that's why lynchings were public and that's why they were photographed. That's why they were attended by family members. It's a way of exerting supreme control and it's also a way of the ultimate humiliation.
So did the African American community also show up for these at all to try to protect people or anything? Or were people like trying to just stay out of the way?
Oh, no. No, you couldn't. No. There were times where black people were at a lynchings. I've seen actually photographs with black people in lynchings, but they were when they were forced to come. It was, again, a situation where it was an opportunity for black people to actually see so that they could then take that information back to the community. Often, black people can talk to you about lynchings in great detail. They can tell you when it happened. They can tell you where it happened. And we'll show you the spot. Whites often know nothing about the lynching. The irony is that whites attended lynchings by the thousands. Blacks weren't even there. It often severed ties, family ties in the black community, because you couldn't say, one, that you were related to a victim of lynching because there was that stigma around having committed rape or some other crime. There was that one thing that kept, that factor that kept you from, it meant that you needed to distance yourself from your family member. The other thing is that you could also be in danger. So there were instances of lynchings where there was a woman who came to retrieve the body of her husband and she was raped and lynched.
Well, I know that anti-lynching campaigns were actually the focus of some of the earliest feminist organizing in this country, especially among black women Ida B. Wells is probably the best known, a black journalist who documented lynching and organized for both women's rights and civil rights. But also Jessie Daniel Ames was a white woman who founded the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching, as well as the Texas League for Women Voters.
Yes.
Is any of that history included in your film?
It is. I'm looking at efforts of Ida B. Wells, in particular her great-grandson Dan Duster is a part of the board for the project. And I am definitely interested in showing the work that she did. It's suggested that that was the impetus for creating the NAACP. Her efforts around lynching sparked their efforts around lynching and their ultimate organization around civil rights and human rights. Not only do you need to know about the injustices that happen, but it's really important to know about the heroes and the people who step forward, whether their efforts were effective or not, that they had the intention to stop the violence. And so when I was filming in St. Louis, Missouri, there was a lynching there in a small college town around the rape of a 14-year-old girl there. Her father tried to stop that lynching. He came out at the risk of his own life to stop that lynching and was almost lynched himself. The victim was not guilty of the rape, but was lynched anyway. But those are the things that's important to know, that you can stand up. And you also need to know that there are things that could have easily have been done behind the scenes that didn't put you in danger, like supporting anti-lynching laws. And so I think that's part of the history that's really important to bring forward, because it really informs what you can do and how you can take action today on behalf of fighting racism and hate.
I think a lot of people's reaction to hearing about a film on lynching would be, yuck, I don't want to hear about all that horror and sadness. And it's true that I cried even during the short excerpt that we saw yesterday. But my sense is that it's not primarily a depressing film. How have you been able to make this film a positive experience for the people who will watch it?
Yeah, so I've often cried too. It's a really weighty subject. I tell people that it's okay to feel anger, to feel sadness, to feel guilt and shame. What really is difficult is when you decide you don't want to feel those things, and so you just put them at arm's length and you don't look at them, and you decide that this history is so distant it has nothing to do with you. But I think it's really important to feel those things if you feel them, but to use that to move towards healing. The thing about this film that's different than any other film on lynching is I'm looking at restorative justice. So I haven't had to do anything except for to follow the efforts of people who are doing things. And so the people in Monroe, the people in Duluth, and many people around the country are really inspiring me as they look at how to acknowledge the victims, how to repair the damage, and then how to come together and heal.
But you are becoming involved in a way in the restorative justice movement yourself through bringing the reenactment movement to the virtual world using a platform called Second Life, which I only heard of very recently, and I don't know very much about it, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners probably don't know what Second Life is. Yeah. So can you explain what it is and what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. Second Life is an online virtual world. Everybody's seen the movie Avatar. You go on Yahoo and you have your avatar that you interact with. So you create your avatar, and then you are interacting with other people via their avatars. Second Life is this huge world, and it literally is like a world. So there are thousands of things you can do in Second Life and thousands of places that you can go. Some of them are social, so I could sit down with you, with your avatar. You could sit down with me. We could have coffee and talk and really get to know each other. You can also go into an educational environment. So there are universities. There's over 700 universities around the world who are present in Second Life. Some of the professors have their classes only in Second Life. So it's this great space where you can learn and you can socialize. And Always in Season Island, then, is a space that we're creating where we're replicating a lynch mob. And we're replicating a mob that took place in Marion, Indiana, where about 10,000 to 15,000 people came to watch that lynching. And two men were lynched and a third man, James Cameron, was saved, and he was saved because someone stepped forward on his behalf at the age of 16. He went on to live until he was 92, and he died in 2005, I believe very, very recently, but led a remarkable life. And so I chose Marion, Indiana for that reason, because not only did someone step forward, and so you have the opportunity to see what that's like and what you can do and how you can take agency in a situation where there's mob violence, but also because his life represents the loss. He was an incredible man, and then you multiply that times the 5,000 to 10,000 victims that were out there, and you can really get a sense of the loss that was lynching.
What stage is this project at now? I know you have a Kickstarter campaign going right now, I think, to raise the money you need to complete it.
Yeah, so I'm in production right now, early production. We started filming last year. And because the events in Monroe, the reenactment, are annual, we need to film again this year in the summer. And so I'm raising funds through Kickstarter. Our goal is $15,000 by this coming Sunday on June 3rd. And if we're able to raise that money, then we can go and film again in Monroe and show the reenactments, speak with the actors and the people of Monroe and all those people who are coming out to attend, and really fully develop that story. If you'd like to check out the project and you want to see more details, there's trailers, there's all kinds of information about the project, including an opportunity to donate. You can go to Kickstarter.com and search Always in Season.
And we will put that link on our website, kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com. I have been speaking with Jacqueline Olive, director and producer of the film Always in Season, exploring the legacy of lynching. There will be several screenings of the promo and opportunities to meet Jackie and ask questions between now and next Sunday when the Kickstarter campaign ends. One of those screenings is coming up on Wednesday, just 2 days from now, and that's co-sponsored by Coming to the Table, an organization which works on reconciliation between descendants of slaves and slaveholders. That screening will be at 7 p.m. on Wednesday, May 30th, at the Attitudinal Healing Center, 3278 West Street in Oakland. You can get more information about Always in Season and find out about future events at their website, www.tellitmedia.org.